Here we are living in poverty in Soho, and Jenny's mother decides to send us luncheon to help with the babies. We've just pawned all of our furniture, you understand. And suddenly we have a servant girl. That's how it is when you marry into the aristocracy. They don't send you money, which you desperately need. They send you fine linen and silverware and a servant. Actually, not a bad idea. The servant can take the fine linen and silverware to the pawn shop and get some money. Blanchard did that many times. But she was never a servant. Jenny had a tremendous affection for her. The girls adored her. Whenever Jenny was sick, Lenchen was at her side, attending to her every need. But yes, her presence created a tension between Jenny and me. I remember a scene. I came downstairs. Jenny said, "I saw you looking at Lenchen this morning." I said, "I don't know what you mean." She said, "I mean the way a man looks at a woman." I still don't know what you mean. It was one of those conversations which could not possibly come to any good. All this was going on inside our tiny flat on Dean Street. Outside was London. Can you imagine London? 1858. Costa girls trying to sell a few rolls for a few pennies. Hurdy-gurdies, brass bands, magicians, fire eaters, prostitutes, the organ grinder with his monkey, and always a beggar girl singing an Irish ballad. That's what I saw and heard as I made my way home from the British Museum. Under the gas lamps, which had just been lit until I got to Dean Street, and then had to walk through the mud and sewage, thinking about the care they took in paving the roads in the wealthy neighborhoods. Although I suppose it's only fitting the author of Das Kapital should have to slog through shit while writing his condemnation of the capitalist system. Jenny didn't sympathize with my wading through the mud. She said, "That's how it feels to me reading Das Kapital." She was always my severest critic. Unsparing. Honest. Is there anything more outrageous than an honest critic? The book troubled her. Yes, Capital. She thought I would bore people from the start with my discussion of commodities, surplus value, exchange value. She thought it was too long, too detailed. She used the word ponderous. Imagine. She reminded me of what our trade union friend Peter Fox said when I gave him the book. He said, "I feel like a man who's been given an elephant for a gift." "Yes, it is an elephant," she said. I tried to explain. "This is not a manifesto, which is intended for the general public. It is an analysis." She said, "Let it be an analysis, but let it cry out like the manifesto. A specter is haunting Europe. The specter of communism." She would say, "That excites a reader. Specter is haunting Europe." And then to irritate me, of course, she would read out some lines from Capital. It should be noted in regard to the accumulation of notes in times of stringency that it is a repetition of the hoarding of precious metal as used to take place in the troubled times in the most primitive conditions of society. The Act of 1844 is interesting in its operation because it seeks to transform all precious metal existing in the country into a circulating medium. It seeks to equate a drain of gold with a contracting of circulating medium and a return flow of gold with an expansion of the circulating medium. Now I ask you, is that boring? All right. Perhaps it is a little boring. I admitted that to Jenny. She said, "There's no such thing as a little boring." Don't misunderstand. She did see Capital as a profound analysis. It showed how the capitalist system must, at a certain stage in history, come into being and enormously increase the productive forces of society, thereby vastly increasing the wealth of the world. But how it must, by its nature, distribute that wealth in such a way as to destroy the humanity of both the capitalist and the laborer. And how it must, by its nature, create its own grave diggers and give way to a more human system. "But are we reaching the people we want to reach?" she would say. She said, "Do you know why the censors have allowed it to be published?" "Because they cannot understand it. And they assume no one else will either."
I reminded her the Capitol was receiving favorable reviews. She reminded me that most of those reviews were written by Engels. I said, well, perhaps you're being critical of my work because you're unhappy with me. She said, you men, you never think your work deserves criticism, so you attribute it to something personal. Yes, Moore, my personal feelings are there, but this is separate. Yes, her personal feelings. Jenny was going through a terrible time then. I suppose I was to blame, but I did not know how to ease her anguish. You must understand, Jenny and I fell in love when she was 17, I was 19. She was marvelous looking. Long, auburn hair, dark eyes. Her family took a liking to me right away. They were aristocrats. Aristocrats are always impressed with intellectuals. Her father and I would get into long discussions about Greek philosophy. I had just finished my doctoral thesis on Democritus and Epicurus, but I was just beginning to see that philosophers had only interpreted the world. The point is to change it. When I was expelled from Germany, Jenny followed me to Paris. There we were married, and she gave birth to Jenishin and Laura. We were happy in Paris, living on nothing, meeting our friends in a cafe. They also lived on nothing. What a bunch we were. Bakunin, the huge, shaggy anarchist. Engels, the handsome atheist. Heine, the saintly poet. Stirner, total misfit. Proudhon, who said, property is theft, but wanted some. Being poor in Paris is one thing. Being poor in London is another. We moved there with two children, and soon Jenny was pregnant again. Sometimes I felt she blamed me for always having to raise our children in a cold, damp flat. Somebody was always sick all of the time. Jenny came down with the smallpox. She recovered, but it left pockmarks on her face. I tried to tell her she was still beautiful. But it didn't help. I wish you could know Jenny. What she did for me cannot be calculated. And she understood that I simply could not get a job like other men. I did try once. I wrote a letter of inquiry to the railroad for a position as a clerk. They responded as follows. Dr. Marx, we are honored at your request for a position here. We've never had a doctor of philosophy working for us as a clerk. However, as the position requires a legible handwriting, we must regretfully decline your offer. Jenny believed in my ideas, but she was impatient with what she considered the pretensions of high-level scholarship. Come down to earth, Herr Doktor, she would say. She wanted me to explain the theory of surplus value so that ordinary workers could understand it. I tried to tell her, no one can understand the theory of surplus value unless you first understand the labor theory of value. That labor is a special commodity whose value is determined by the cost of the means of subsistence, and yet gives value to all other commodities, a value which always exceeds the value of labor itself. She would say, no. That won't do. All you have to say is this. Your employer pays you the barest amount in wages, just enough for you to survive and work. But in return, by your labor power, he makes far greater than he pays you. So he gets richer and richer while you stay poor. All right. Let us suppose that only 100 individuals in world history have ever understood my theory of surplus value. It's still true.
Just the other day, I was reading your United States Department of Labor statistics. There you have it. Your workers are producing more and more and receiving less and less in wages. What is the result? The richest 1% of Americans control 40% of the wealth. And this is the great model of world capitalism, a nation that has not only robbed its own citizens, it's sucked in the wealth of the rest of the world. You see, Jenny was always trying to simplify ideas which were, by their nature, complex. She accused me of being an academic first and a revolutionary second. Forget your intellectual readers, she would say. Address the workers. She called me arrogant and intolerant. She said, why do you attack other revolutionaries more vehemently than you attack the bourgeoisie? Proudhon, for instance. The man simply did not understand that we must applaud capitalism for its development of giant industry and then take them over. Proudhon thought we had to retreat into a more simple society. So when he wrote his book, The Philosophy of Poverty, I replied with my own book, The Poverty of Philosophy. I thought that was pretty clever. Jenny thought it was insulting. I suppose she was a better human being than I could ever be. She did encourage me to get off my behind and get involved in the cause of the London workers. She was with me when I was asked to address the very first meeting of the International Working Men's Association, St. Martin's Hall. Workers of all countries must unite against foreign policies which are criminal, which play upon national prejudices and squander in wars the people's blood and treasure. We must combine across national boundaries to vindicate in international affairs the simple laws of morals and justice. Workers of the world, unite. Jenny liked that. She kept the family going. The water cut off. The gas cut off. She never tired of the subject of female emancipation. She said the vitality of women was being sapped by being forced to stay at home and cook and sew. So she refused to stay at home. She accused Engels and I of being theoretically emancipationist but practically ignorant of the problems of women. You and Engels, she said, you write about sexual equality, but you do not practice it. Well, I won't comment on that. She supported with all her heart the Irish struggle. Queen Victoria had said, "These Irish are really abominable people, not at all like any other civilized nation." So Jenny wrote a letter to the London newspapers, "England hangs Irish rebels for wanting freedom. Is England a civilized nation?" Jenny and I were powerfully in love. How can I make you understand that? Yes, there were difficult times in Soho, London, but the love was still there. At a certain point, things changed. I don't know why. Jenny said it was because she was no longer the great beauty I had wooed. That made me angry. Then she said it was because of luncheon. That made me even more angry. Then she said I was angry because it was true. That made me furious. So they keep saying, and since the Soviet Union collapsed, communism is dead. Do these idiots know what communism is? Do they think a system run by a thug who murders his fellow revolutionaries is communism? Scheißkampf. Journalists, politicians who say such things, what education did they have? Did they read the Communist Manifesto, which Engels and I wrote when he was 28 and I was 30? In place of bourgeois society with its classes and class antagonisms, we shall have a free association in which the free development of each is the precondition for the free development of all.
Do you hear that? An association. What do they think the purpose of communism is? Freedom for the individual to develop himself or herself as a compassionate human being. Do they think someone who calls himself a socialist or a communist and acts like a gangster understands what communism is? To shoot those who disagree with you. Could that be the communism that I gave my life for? That monster who took all power for himself in Russia and insisted on interpreting my ideas like a religious fanatic. When he was lining up his old comrades before a firing squad, did he allow his citizens to read the letter that I wrote to the New York Tribune in which I said that capital punishment could not be justified in any society calling itself civilized? Socialism is not supposed to reproduce the stupidities of capitalism. Here in America, your prisons are overcrowded. Who's in them? The poor. Now, sure, some of them have committed violent, even terrible, crimes. Most of them are burglars, robbers, thieves, sellers of drugs. They believe in free enterprise. They do what the capitalists do, but on a much smaller scale. Do you know what Engels and I wrote about prisons? Rather than imprison individuals for their crimes, we should destroy the social conditions which engender crime and give to each person the scope he needs to develop himself in society. Yes, we spoke of a dictatorship of the proletariat, not a dictatorship of one man, not a dictatorship of one party or one central committee, a temporary dictatorship of the proletariat, the mass of people would take over the state and govern in the interests of all, until the state itself eventually became unnecessary and would gradually wither away. Bakunin, of course, disagreed. He thought that a state, any state, even a worker state, if it had police, an army, prisons, would eventually become a tyranny. He loved to argue with me. Do you know him? Bakunin, the anarchist? If a novelist invented such a character, you would say the existence of such a person is not possible. To say that Bakunin and I did not get along is a great understatement. For instance, listen to what he wrote when Engels and I were in Brussels working on the manifesto. Marx and Engels, and especially Marx, are ingrained bourgeois. We are ingrained bourgeois. Of course, to Bakunin, everyone was bourgeois because he chose to live like a pig. If you did not live like a pig, if you had a roof over your head, if you occasionally enjoyed some fresh bread and wine, if you had a piano in your sitting room, you were a bourgeois. Now, I grant the man courage. He was imprisoned, sent to Siberia, escaped. He wandered the world trying to foment a revolution everywhere. He wanted an anarchist society. The only anarchism he ever succeeded in setting up was in his own head. He tried to start an uprising in Bologna, and he almost shot himself with his own revolver. His revolutions failed miserably everywhere, but he was like a man whose failure with women just spurs him on to more. You ever see a photograph of Bakunin? Giant of a man. Massive beard, ferocious expression, bald head, which he covered with a small gray cap. No teeth, scurvy, the result of his prison diet. He seemed to live not in this world, but in some world of his imagination. He had no concept of money. When he had it, he gave it away. When he didn't have it, he borrowed it without any thought of returning it. He had no home. Or you could say the world was his home. He would arrive at a comrade's doorstep, unannounced, and say, I'm here. Where do I sleep? And what is there to eat? And in an hour, he was more at home than his hosts. There was a time we were having dinner in Soho. Bakunin burst in, didn't bother to knock. It was his habit to arrive right at dinner time. We were surprised. We thought he was in Italy somewhere. Whenever we heard about him, he was off organizing a revolution. Well, this time he practically knocked the door off its hinges, came in, looked around, smiled his toothless smile, and said, "Good evening, comrades." Didn't wait for a response. He sat down at the table and began devouring meat and sausage in enormous chunks, stuffing in fistfuls of cheese and downing it with glass after glass after glass of brandy. I said, "Mikhail, try the wine." "Brandy's expensive. We have plenty of wine." He took one sip of wine and spat it out. "Absolutely tasteless. Brandy helps you think more clearly." And then he stood up and began his usual performance. Preaching, shouting, ordering, exhorting. I was furious. It was Jenny who finally spoke up. She said, "Stop it, Mikhail. You're consuming all of the oxygen in the room." Bakunin's head was full of all kinds of anarchist garbage. Romantic, utopian, nonsense. I wanted to expel him from the International. Jenny said, "Why do revolutionary groups with 6 members always threaten somebody with expulsion?" He had a million disguises. The police were looking for him in every country in Europe. This time when he came to us, he was dressed as a priest. At least he thought so. He looked ridiculous. Well, he was with us a week. One night, we stayed up all night, drinking, arguing, drinking some more, till neither of us could stand. In fact, I fell asleep in the midst of one of Bakunin's perorations. He shook me until I woke up. He said, "I haven't finished my point." It was that glorious time in the winter of 1871. The Commune was in power in Paris. Paris Commune. Bakunin leapt with his full bulk into that revolution. The French understood him. They had a saying. On the first day of a revolution, Bakunin is a treasure. On the second day, he should be shot. Do you know that magnificent episode in human history, Paris Commune? Whose story begins with stupidity. Yes, I'm speaking of Napoleon III, nephew of Bonaparte. He was a stage actor, smiling to the crowd. Meanwhile, 6 million French peasants lived in blind, dark hovels, their children dying of starvation. But because he kept a legislature, because people voted, it was thought they had a democracy. Common mistake. Well, Bonaparte wanted glory, so he decided to attack Bismarck's armies. He was quickly defeated, whereupon the victorious German troops marched into Paris and were greeted by something more devastating than guns. Silence. The statues of Paris were draped in enormous black cloths, an immense, invisible, silent resistance. The Germans did the wise thing. They paraded through the Arc de Triomphe and quickly departed. Now, the old French order, the Republic, liberals, they called themselves. They were trembling with fear. They were afraid to enter the city. Because now, with the German soldiers gone, Paris was taken over by the workers. The housewives, the clerks, the intellectuals, the armed citizens, the people of Paris formed not a government, something more glorious, something governments everywhere fear. The Commune. It was the Commune du Paris. People meeting 24 hours a day in knots of 3 and 4 all over the city, making decisions together. Meanwhile, the French army encircled, threatening to invade at any moment. Paris became the first free city in the world. an enclave of liberty in a world of tyranny. I said to Bakunin, do you want to know what I mean by the dictatorship of the proletariat? Look at the Paris Commune. That is real democracy. Not the democracy of England or America, where elections are circuses. Where the choice is between this or that guardian of the old order, and whichever candidate wins, the rich go on ruling the country. No, it only lasted 2 months, but the Paris Commune was the first government in history to represent the poor. Its laws were for them. It abolished their debts, postponed their rents. They forced the pawn shops to return their most needed possessions. They lowered the hours of bakers. They refused to take wages higher than those of the workers. And they planned to give free admission for everyone to the theater. The great Courbet himself, whose paintings had stunned Europe, presided over the Federation of Artists. They reopened the museums. And they set up a commission for the education of women. Something unheard of. Education for women. They took advantage of the latest in science. The lighter-than-air balloon. And they launched one out from Paris to float over the countryside and drop printed papers to the peasants with a simple, powerful message. A message that should be dropped to working people everywhere. Our interests are the same. Commune declared the purpose of schools to teach children to love and respect their fellow creatures. Now, I've read your endless discussions on education. Such nonsense. You teach everything necessary to succeed in a capitalist world, but do you teach the youth to struggle for justice? The Commune understood the importance of that. They educated not only by their words, but by their acts. They abolished the guillotine, that instrument of tyranny, even revolutionary tyranny. And then, wearing red scarves, a red banner, flying, buildings festooned in sheets of red silk, they gathered around the Vendome Column, a symbol of military power, an enormous statue surmounted by the giant bronze head of Napoleon Bonaparte. A pulley was attached to the head. A capstan turned, and the head came crashing to the ground. People climbed atop the ruins. Now the red flag flew from its pedestal. Now it was a statue not of one nation, but of the entire human race. And men and women watching wept with joy. Yes. That was the Paris Commune. Streets were always full, discussions going on everywhere. People shared things. Kindness ruled. They seemed to smile more often. The streets were completely safe, without police of any kind. Yes, that was socialism. But of course, that example could not be allowed. So the French army invaded, commenced a slaughter. Leaders of the Commune were taken to Père Lachaise Cemetery, lined up against a wall, and shot. Altogether, 30,000 were killed.
And that was Brian Jones portraying Karl Marx in Howard Zinn's play Marx in Soho, performed for KPFK Radio in 2001 in Los Angeles. Today's show was written and produced by Mark Torres and Brian DeShazer, and executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and your host, Brian DeShazer. From the Vault is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and you, the Pacifica listeners.